The House Committee on Healthcare Subcommittee on Health Policy to order and open up a work session on House Bill 2188. Back before us today, we have folks from the immunization program, and we've already had a public hearing on this. And so, if you wouldn't mind coming back up, I know you had an amendment that we should walk through with the group. Dash one amendments. Does everybody have a copy? Sandy, would you let us know what's going on?
That's just brief. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. Yes, we did have a public hearing on this bill January 23rd. At that time, the agency spoke to the removal of two words, a provider. That amendment is the dash one amendment, which should be behind your SMS, dated 12507. And it does just delete those two words, or provider. Pardon me, it wasn't and, provider. And Representative Bruin had a question post our public hearing, and I believe that's what we have the agency back before us to help talk us through that as far as penalties.
That'd be helpful. Representative Bruin, did you want to?
And we're not going to discuss dash one at this point. We're just going to discuss dash two, or it's all part of the. It's all part. Okay. I would, yes. Thank you for coming back. And we had a little bit of discussion before we gaveled in. Regarding this, you have a copy of the dash two, but the dash two amendments would add a class A misdemeanor to any violation of the any violation by anybody conducting these the immunization records. And just love to hear your the pros. We talked a little bit about the pros and cons, but let's get the pros and cons on record.
Madam Chair and Representative Bruin. The immunization program in the last 10... Lorraine Duncan, Immunization Program, Department of Human Services. The alert registry has been in operation for about 10 years, as we talked about. And as we also talked about, they haven't had any breach of confidentiality or security. And I think it's really clear that when the information comes into the statewide immunization registry, it's a pretty... has the demographics and the child's immunization record. But when we share that information with authorized users, it's only a subset of information that goes on the web server. So the only thing on the web server is the child's name, the birth date, and the shots, and what shots are currently due. So nobody has information about demographics or last provider or any information like that. So it's a really limited subset. We really are not in favor of adding the civil penalty, but that's certainly
right.
To you.
Okay. Hey, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. And I was prompted to ask this by Sandy, so I appreciate Sandy prompting me to do so. Can you sort of go through the HIPAA requirements related to this as you understand them?
Sure. Madam Chair and Representative Bruin, that HIPAA applies to healthcare providers and health plans, and it's regarding the security of data. And it's my understanding that they have a civil penalty per incident of $100 that would be charged for being in violation of such an example of not following the alert regulations.
Okay. So we have two amendments before us on the bill. And in terms of the dash two amendments, I would entertain a motion if you would like to add, we can have some discussion about making it more apparent in the statute about what a civil penalty would be for misuse of alert information. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know if we're ready. I mean, this...
Oh. Representative Greenlee?
Yeah. Is a Class A misdemeanor the most serious or the least serious of misdemeanors?
I believe.
Madam Chair, Representative Greenlee. My understanding, a Class A misdemeanor is $1,000 fine up to a year in prison, if I'm understanding. And I believe it is the most severe of the A, Bs, or Cs.
So this isn't a civil penalty we're talking about.
It's criminal.
We're creating a new criminal offense that could add up to a year in prison. Does anybody have any idea what the fiscal might be on that, under the assumptions that there are some violations that go with this? I mean, if there are any violations, there's no fiscal, but if there are any violations, you don't need to do anything about it. So if there are some violations, we're creating criminal proceedings plus criminal penalties.
Can Can I address?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and Representative Greenlee, like, I think that's a great point. I want to give you my mindset for requesting that the Dash 2 amendment be drawn up. It was simply when we had our first hearing, if you will, on 2188, talking about these, you know, this sort of this new world we're living in, and the new world of vast cataloging and potentially vast dissemination of personal private information that's all done through the internet. And that's wonderful for records keeping and efficiency and everything else. But with that, as we also know, in this brave new world, comes potentials for violation. I mean, we've had, not that this is the committee to discuss this necessarily, but the ID theft and everything that goes with it. So when we were discussing this cataloging information, it just, on a whim, I looked at statute to see what the penalty was, and there was no penalty in statute. So this came only from that recognition and that discussion. A discussion on should it be a Class A misdemeanor rather than a B or a C, it didn't come up. This is sort of what was generated out. So I'm more than open to you know, changes this amendment if they're deemed necessary and relevant. I'm also open, I mean, as just one committee person, to being dissuaded from putting this forward if I had full confidence that the current law or the current requirements were enough teeth, if you will, to keep people from potentially violating this. It was just Representative Greenlee, for your benefit, it was shared prior to gaveling in that there is what's the right word for the people who do just, I mean, records keepers.
Representative Boone, authorized users are the ones.
Authorized
that
users, okay. The authorized users, when they to become an authorized user, actually have to sign a form. Among other things, it the form indicates that if they violate any of the confidences of the confidentiality within their job, they are subject to termination, which I think is a good thing to have. I'm not sure. I still have some questions, though. That termination is enough of a disincentive, if you will, in this new age we live in.
Representative Gelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the intention here, which is to make sure that private information is kept confidential. I think one of my concerns is the severity that's here, and I'm reflecting on, I previously worked for Department of Human Services, Seniors and People with Disabilities, where we managed and maintained all sorts of extraordinarily confidential information that went beyond kind of what would be in this database, the shots that are needed, criminal histories, developmental histories, mental health histories, and we didn't have penalties that were this severe. So I wonder how this would fit in terms of being consistent with the way that we have penalties through other parts of the system where public agencies maintain very private information, and whether or not this would cause us to need to go back and re-examine that through all of the government agencies that maintain confidential information, whether that be educational, medical, mental health, criminal. But I appreciate what you're trying to do in terms of protecting the information of.
Can I address that? Mm-hmm. I would only say that it would be, I guess, from a personal standpoint, my desire to get a sense of the committee, because once again, this sort of came out of a private, after we gabbled out, sort of conversation. So I don't pretend to have the input from the committee, you know, on record or even off the record, inclusively. So it'd be wonderful to get, while looking at this, to get a sense of the committee that, first of all, A, is something needed above and beyond what the current regulations are, and B, if it's not a Class A misdemeanor, what is it? I mean, so we could sort of send that out to LC to draft an amendment.
I think Representative Forrest.
Representative Forrest.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I think what we heard earlier as defining what are the HIPAA applications or violation requirements. What, could you repeat that again? What I heard was $100 per violation. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Flores, yes, I understand that the HIPAA follow-up for punishment or civil penalty is $100 per incident.
Well, if we're thank you. Mm-hmm. And if we're looking for something to have some sort of a overlay or protocol, maybe that would be something we could emulate. $100 per incident, whether or not it meets your, but I think that would be some sort of violation and something even alongside of possible termination of your from your position.
Representative Bonavich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I'd like to have a little bit more conversation about whether we have a need for this, and particularly a criminal penalty. I did look up the Class A misdemeanor is $6,250 for a fine and a year in prison. And a question whether we need to take prison space with people.
Right.
When our intent is to make sure that the confidentiality is respected. So assuming that there's a need for something beyond what's there, I'd rather look at some sort of civil remedy than criminalizing this behavior. So I'd like to work on something that will make sure the incentive is there to keep the information confidential but doesn't criminalize the violation.
Question from Ms. Duncan. When on the form itself, when they say, does it mention the $100 HIPAA issue? What does it actually say? Like, okay. If you violate usage, you...
Yeah, I'm just curious. Madam Chair, the form reads, as a condition of receiving immunization information from Alert as a provider, defined in ORS 433-090, we agree to the following. One, only access immunization information in Alert for children under our care are enrolled in our plan. Two, read and abide by the Alert confidentiality policy. Abide by all security policies and procedures, including safeguarding our user identification number and computer password against unauthorized use. And four, permit the Alert director to monitor and audit the use of the system. And that closes with, we understand that failure to abide by this agreement may result in immediate termination, suspension, or revoking of the access to the Alert data system. Misuse of the Alert data would be reported to the appropriate licensing body. And it doesn't mention the HIPAA.
And who is the appropriate licensing body?
So if it was a physician, it would be the Board of Medical Examiners. Or
okay. Because one of the things we might consider is whatever we come up with actually mentioning what type of financial penalty might be involved. Because one of the advantages of addressing this issue is as we move into the adult population, mm-hmm. we don't want someone to come down the line and say, I want my name taken out because I don't think there's enough protection. And if we can assure people that there is enough protection, then they're going to stay in the registry, which is kind of what we're trying to do here. Mm-hmm. We want to expand that information base. So what I'm hearing from the group is there's interest in maybe doing something, but this amendment's not quite right. So maybe what we do is move the dash ones now and then come back on Friday with a revised.
Well, I suggest that you do that, that you move the bill to the full committee with the dash ones, and then if there's some interest in the committee.
At the full?
Mm-hmm. At the full committee and having another amendment, we can deal with it in a work session at the,
put an amendment in.
At the full committee on Friday morning.
Make a sense of what.
Violation.
So one of the things that was suggested in lieu of this would be something referencing the HIPAA violation. Representative Gelsler, do you have a suggestion?
Yes, I was just going to suggest if we could have in the statute that the contracts with the providers would indicate the penalties of violating HIPAA requirements, and that be stated clearly on the form when people receive them, including that financial penalty.
Representative Floyd.
Thank you. Just a little reference to Chair Greenlick's recommendation to take it to the full before we have it work through here. I'm just wonder if I could probe that decision a little bit as to why that would be the your course of delivery.
Yeah, we need to start moving bills through, and it seems to me that in a few days, if you all can come to some decision on what you want to do with this, a civil penalty or some other statement, we could put the dash ones in, send it to the full committee with the dash ones, and then work on an amendment if there's agreement on the amendment in the full committee. I mean, I'll tell you, my opinion is that this is not... You know, compared to the data we look at all the time that we worry about that's in data systems, the fact that whether little Johnny had a measles shot or didn't have a measles shot is not really very sensitive data. So I'm not moved by the fact that this is something anybody's going to try and hack into and sell. I mean, who cares? It's not like there's social security number identified with it. It's not like there's financial data. It's not like there's even disease data. I mean, it isn't like Well, Johnny got syphilis from his mother or something. I mean, that just isn't going to be here. But it seems to me I'd like to get things moving. And if there's an amendment, I'd be happy to take it up on Friday in the full committee.
Representative.
Thank you. And thank you for that. I'm just, number one, potentially information that is on that database system could in fact include Social Security numbers since children are provided those at birth, and that's an identifier that would follow the child.
That's not the identifier that they use.
Madam Chair and Representative Flores, what we do is we have a full data set, and then when we put the information into the website server, which is what the authorized users access, there's only that limited data set. So we don't transfer any of the demographics, Social Security number. It just has the name of the child, you know, first, middle, and last, the birth date, the shots that they've had, and what shots they're due for. But no demographics or Social Security number.
In light of that, may I have a question?
Yep.
Thank you. Then what would happen if we had two Susie A. Smiths born on February 14th, 1999.
Madam Chair and Representative Flores, when the data comes from the providers into the main database, all that information, the demographics, the Social Security number, the mother's maiden name, sometimes the hospital of birth, the address, the phone numbers, all comes in, and then we deduplicate. So we deduplicate the demographics based on that information, and then sometimes we have to deduplicate the immunization records because we get it from three different doctors. Once they're deduplicated, they go onto the web server for the authorized user. Not to say that there's never a duplicate on the web server, because sometimes there is, but the idea is to try to always get the deduplication done in the main database before it's loaded onto the web server for the access to the authorized users.
But quick follow-up.
If a
school, for example, they had a Susie Smith and they had three Susie Smiths come up when they entered it, could they then call alert and say, and then verbally get the information so they could figure out which Susie Smith they had?
Representative Kotex, that's exactly what they can do. We have a hotline that's staffed every day, and then people can just call, and then we look it up in the main database.
Based on the information you only have access
right.
to.
Right.
Okay. Okay. Is that...
Yes.
That question.
Thank you.
Well, in terms of, I would like to see some kind of declaration on the form that this does have a HIPAA violation. I guess the question for me is, do we also need to have something in statute? And I'm getting a sense from some that that's a no, some that's a maybe.
Yes, question. Can you put civil penalties in by administrative rule? And you need statutory authority to do that.
I don't know that.
Can I?
Yeah, Representative Wilson. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to clarify what we're talking about, are we talking about adding an additional civil penalty, or are we talking about imposing just what's already there via HIPAA and making explicit on the form what the federal laws are that overlay this?
I think that hasn't been determined. So,
okay.
You know, one thing they could do right now is clarify it on the form. The amendment is talking about adding something into statute, either a clarification of the civil penalty related to HIPAA or a penalty related that we, in addition to that, not clear.
So given that, and because I understand the concerns that are being raised and want to make sure that they're understood, but would it potentially be a workable solution that it becomes part of the legislative record because we've had this discussion that it is the intent of the committee that these HIPAA laws and the penalty for violation be made explicit on the form with the agency being here to hear that information, that might be a solution that we could move forward with, or do committee members feel that we need something more explicit in statute to provide the protections around the issues that are raised?
Representative Brune, in light of the conversation,
yeah.
I think people are open to...
Right, to being swayed. there's a whole bunch of things that hadn't thought of until, 20 minutes ago. But, I think the idea that we don't have to do via legislation is to have the agencies have that on the form. I think it's a great idea, and it sounds like you sort of agree with that, and we can do that by having this conversation. I think that's wonderful. I do not think it is a bad precedent to set, and I realize that what Representative Greenlick is saying, that in the larger world of personal data, this may not be, you know, as important to personal data, this may not be very, what we're talking about here may not be very significant. Nevertheless, I think it does serve as good precedent for this body, for this committee and this larger body as a legislature, to start putting a little bit of teeth, even if it's not a Class A misdemeanor. I mean, it's just, you know, a $25 slap on the knuckles. It's not a bad precedent for us to begin doing that, because so much of our lives are built around data and data transfer. And so that's, I mean, once again, I don't want to be obstinate at all about this. It's not my goal at all. It was just to raise this issue. And it's a real concern. It doesn't mean I don't vote for the bill if it's not in there, but I think it's a real concern, something we got to think about and start looking at. So.
Representative Bonnie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree with Representative Bruin's concerns. However, we're looking at a system that's already in place. If this were a brand new system rather than an expansion of an existing system, I think I'd have more of a concern. But in light of the testimony that they haven't had problems to date, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
I think that I feel comfortable going ahead with the record and with the understanding that there will be something in the form. And I was also noticing that there's even an obligation in Section 5, Paragraph 4, that they have to ensure that the registry receiving the data has confidentiality and security policies, at least as stringent as the policies of the registry sharing the data. So we already have something in the existing statute addressing confidentiality and security. So if we were looking at something brand new, or if we were looking at something that where there was some indicia that there had been problems, I might be a little bit more cautious, but I'm prepared to move forward.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative.
And thank you. And I would just, I concur with Representative Bonamici. I would just remind us each that it was just a few weeks ago where there were some serious breaches of data systems affecting some of our major data frameworks, and I am a total geek when it comes to all of this, but it was of a very universal nature, never having been breached before, but it is just something that also is built into the doability. I mean, if there's something there, there is some hacker stashed away somewhere who can focus on nothing but this. And maybe they don't want your immunization records, but maybe they do for whatever nefarious plot reason. Although I would agree that I will support this bill without that provision in there, but we cannot lose sight of the fact that it is a technological age and we have technological mischief makers. And I will just also add that I appreciate Chair Greenlick's desire to start moving bills, but, you know, I've heard that from a number of committees, and I'm concerned about moving bills without crafting good piece of legislation to be sound public policy just for the matter of expedition. So that will be all I say.
And thank you for your comments. Here's what I'd like to do. I think the chair and vice chairs of the full committee, we haven't had one of our bills actually go to the full committee yet. Am I correct? Even though we passed the bill out last week.
Last week.
And so we are actually meeting tomorrow to discuss where we're going in the committee. So we should have that conversation, I think, about do we want to move things to the full that might need to be amended. And then I would ask Representative Bruin to lead the pack if you would like to continue to work on the Dash 2 amendments, because we could have something on the Senate side. I do agree with Representative Gelser that we need something in proportion to the type of data. I think the class, whatever they came up with, the Class A sounds a little stiff in retrospect to what other things are out there. But I understand what you're saying about, you know, we do have an obligation to protect the data. So I would say go back, look at some other amendments. We could possibly either do it in the full or wait until the Senate side and we can come back together.
Look at a Class D violation as a possibility.
Class D, okay.
Class D violation.
And if you do get an amendment quickly and it looks like we can do it in the full when we come up, then I would just suggest we get to every committee member to make that smooth when we go to the full for that amendment. And so what I would do now is entertain motions of Dash 1.
Second.
Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. I move that we adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2188.
Representative Bonamici has moved that we consider the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2188. Any discussion? Seeing none, Seeing no objections, we'll adopt the Dash 1 amendments as proposed. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that we adopt House Bill 2188 with the Dash 1 amendments and refer it to the full health care committee. With a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Bonamici moves that we pass 2188-1 with a due pass recommendation to the full health care committee. Any discussion? Representative Gelsen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just pondering a comment that Representative Bruin made, and I wanted to thank you for raising the issue of the importance of raising the issue around data. And I think that this is an issue. While I'm not especially concerned about the particular data that's reflected in this bill, I think that data related to children is something that flies around all over the place, and we tend to not necessarily think about that in terms of identity theft and other issues because they're children. But in an age of technology, when things stay around forever as we move forward with other policies, I think it's very important that we think about the importance of confidential information related to children. So thank you for triggering that discussion. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Further discussion on the... Further discussions? Seeing none, I think we'll have a roll call vote on House Bill 2188-1 amendments with a due pass recommendation to the full health care committee. Erin, if you'd read the roll.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative
Gilson. Aye.
Vice Chair Bonamici.
Aye.
Vice Chair Bruin.
Aye.
Chair Kotek.
Aye.
That's the only way to make sure we get there.
Mm-hmm. Do I have a carrier for the bill?
To the full?
No.
To the full? Do we need a carrier?
Yes.
Not to the full.
We need a carrier to the full, sir.
To the full?
Yes.
Really?
Yes. Somebody needs.
Someone needs
a Madam Chair.
I'm sorry. Oh, no, go right ahead.
Madam Chair. Representative Greenwich, yes, somebody needs to present it to the full in a work session.
Is that how we're going
to do it? So there is a carrier in this situation.
Okay. Representative Bruin,
have
you been interested in doing it?
Yeah.
Thank you. So Representative Bruin will carry it to the full health care committee and close the work session on House Bill 2188. Thank you, everyone. Next item on the agenda is an informational meeting. I'm going to open an informational meeting. The remainder of the meeting. Today we have Jim Dameron from the Oregon Patient Safety Commission. We asked Mr. Dameron to come today. Please come up. Because we will be hearing a bill on Thursday related to infection rates at hospitals and thought that it might be helpful information to hear from what the Patient Safety Commission has been working on and some preliminary findings they have in preparation for Thursday's hearing of that bill. So thank you for coming.
Thank you. Madam Chair Kotek, members of the committee, my name is Jim Dameron. I am the administrator of the Oregon Patient Safety Commission. Our office is in Portland, and thank you for inviting me. As I prepared for this session, I was thinking, well, let's do a PowerPoint presentation, and I was hammering away. I got up to 53 slides, and I said, this isn't a good idea. So I would hope to have a less formal, a more informal presentation, but I have put together a packet of information. I would love to walk you through that, but I would also love to entertain your questions as they came up, if that was appropriate. In the packet is there are four documents. One is my attempt to give you a sense of what the commission is, organized along four, what I see as critical dimensions, four critical capacities of the Patient Safety Commission. The second document is our preliminary findings from our 2006 aggregate hospital report. Third is a recent editorial from the Oregonian speaking to the Patient Safety Commission and giving a little bit of sense of increasing visibility for the commission and how we're perceived in the community. And fourth is a list of the board of directors of the Patient Safety Commission. All right. Shall I just sort of walk through this and see how it goes?
That'd be great.
Okay.
Thank you.
First chunk of information.
Mr. Dermott, may I interrupt? How did the commission come about? And maybe you're going to address that.
Let's start right there with the organizational history of the commission. The commission is a creature of the legislature. It was created in 2003, and it was given the mission of reducing the risk of serious adverse events and encouraging a culture of patient safety. That's its mission. That's in statute 2003. It was created as a semi-independent state agency. It's one of those funny little hybrid organizations. I see it in my secret moments as an attempt at what I think of as scrappy government. It's got a public focus, but it's lean, and it's meant to move quickly and to bridge public-private ability to partner as appropriate. So I get up in the morning, and I go to work, and I like what I do, and I think of it as, okay, we're gonna move quickly here, and we're gonna honor that attempt at scrappy government. I work for a board of directors that's a 17-member board, appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate. You have a list of those members. It says in statute that the members will represent the diversity of healthcare interest in the state. So there is a formula that was hammered out in the legislature as to the representation. So there are, I sometimes think of it as the Noah's Ark approach to board. There are two hospital members, and there are two physicians, and there are nurses, there are two consumers, long-term care. So it's, again, meant to represent the cross-section of stakeholders in healthcare. The current chair of the commission is Glenn Rodriguez, a physician, and a good person to work with. Funding for the commission. We receive no state dollars. We have the ability to assess fees on participating organizations. We can accept or seek grants, and we can seek charitable contributions. So when we started in our first year, we had no money, we had no infrastructure, we had an idea, and so the first thing we had to do was roll up our sleeves and creatively put our hand out and seek funds. So we were able to do that. We raised about $270,000 from 19 different stakeholders, hospitals, health plans, plaintiffs, attorneys. We were all over the place. And I think that starts to speak to the kind of centrist location of the commission. The commission seeks to find a center place. So as I see it, the defining features of the Patient Safety Commission is we have a clear and narrow focus. We focus on patient safety, which is one dimension of healthcare quality. Quality is more than patient safety, but patient safety is essential to any, in my opinion, essential to any discussion about quality of care. We're independent. We have a multi-stakeholder table, and I'll give you some examples of how we try to leverage that independence as we proceed. I believe that we have a philosophy that resonates with folks. We are the organization that is looking to talk about medical errors and adverse events in a non-punitive, non-regulatory way. It's not a shame and blame approach. We believe that most medical errors occur because of system problems, communication problems that are inherent in the complexity of healthcare. And that to root them out, you have to create a safe place to talk, a safe place to learn, and that's our role. It's not the only role. You need regulators. You need ability to come down on individual providers who screw up. But that's not our role. Our role is to create a safe place to learn, to discover, to create quality improvement initiatives. So it's a piece of the action, and I believe it's a critical piece. We can protect information. We have built into our statutes strong confidentiality protections on information shared with us, because we're asking for information that hospitals and others have been reluctant to share in the past. We're asking them to tell us about medical errors. We're asking them to tell us about the root causes, the contributing factors that led to those events. We're asking for information about what they intend to do about it. But our goal is to drive quality improvement. Our goal is not to create scorecards or individual hospital comparisons. It's part of that centrist position. Consumers might say, well, we want to know more about a scorecard approach. That's not part of the voluntary confidential package that was set up. That's not currently in our mission. We create for the public aggregate reporting and attempt to create a place where folks can talk about how they can be safe when they go to seek health care, but we don't provide that scorecard approach. I think that as we collect information about hospitals and about nursing homes and about ambulatory surgery centers and other kinds of organizations, we can speak to transition of care issues. We try to look across the continuum of care. So if there are quality patient safety events, errors that are occurring in handoffs between nursing homes and hospitals, between ambulatory surgery centers and hospitals, we start to offer the possibility of capturing information about that and putting mechanisms in place to improve, to work, to do better. And finally, I think... Yeah.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you. Jim, you talked about voluntary before. We were talking about the elements of your system that are voluntary and the elements that are not voluntary.
Okay. And we have... Chair Kotek, Representative Greenlick, we have in place a kind of interesting hybrid approach and with multiple kinds of accountability. The essential premise is that, let's just talk about hospitals. There are other organizations that participate. Let's focus for hospitals for the minute. Hospitals have a choice. They can participate in our reporting program or not. It's a voluntary program. At this point, 54 of 57 hospitals have chosen to participate. We have signed agreements with those hospitals. That's a voluntary choice, in or out. Once they decide to participate, they sign an agreement that specifies what they need to do, that they have to share detailed information using our definitions, our reporting framework. They have to tell the patient in writing, I'll come back to this later, written notification of an adverse event to the patient. That's one of the accountabilities. We might not create a scorecard, but we insist that hospitals share information with patients if a serious adverse event occurs. We insist that hospitals will have action plans and that they'll share details of what those are. So it's you're in or you're out, your choice, but if you're in, you have to agree to some pretty stringent guidelines. And so far, we have those 54, 57 hospitals. Those 54 hospitals represent 99% of inpatient care given in Oregon. Okay?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question that I can see how much the confidentiality needs to exist as an incentive for reporting. But I wonder, as a semi-independent state agency, how that's structured so that you're not part of public records or subject to discovery in lawsuits brought by... malpractice lawsuits. How is that working?
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Bonamici, in statute are some modeled after peer review protections, some pretty stringent legal language about those sorts of issues. Information shared with the commission, defined as patient safety data. Such data are not are confidential, are not discoverable, cannot be subpoenaed, are not subject to public records or public meeting laws. So, and that's explicitly stated in the statute. And it's not been challenged yet. But again, it's based on a good model for peer protection, which has stood the test of time in Oregon. So it's an important part. I think it's well thought out. So far, it's working. Because we've gotten part of the initial conversation, this is a voluntary system. We had to convince every hospital and every legal department and every risk manager and every hospital in the state that this will work. We promise to keep your information confidential. That's the deal. And they all had to independently make their legal reviews and sign an agreement. So that it passed the test with those folks.
And it looks like you're ramping up different parts of your reporting.
Right. Let's talk about that next. So the second dimension is that we have a responsibility to build these voluntary and confidential reporting programs for six kinds of organizations, for hospitals, for nursing homes, for retail pharmacies, for ambulatory surgery centers, for freestanding renal dialysis and birthing centers. Six kinds. It's a lot of work. So far, we have gotten the hospital program up and running. As I said, we've had good success in getting that started. That started in May of last year, and I'll talk, if you'd like me to, I can talk about the data that we've collected for 2006. I'll come back to that later. We work via administrative rules. We are responsible to the public via administrative rules process. So we put all that in place for the hospitals last year and got that program up and running. We, in parallel fashion, we have now gotten administrative rules for a pharmacy program. They went into effect January 1 of this year, and now we're in the recruitment stage. Again, the voluntary model. And as part of the lean government, we have to make our case. We don't do things by fiat. We have to make our case. We have to prove that this is a reasonable deal. And now we're doing that with pharmacies. Nursing home rules are being vetted right now. There's a public hearing for those rules on February 21st. We hope to put those rules into place on March 1, and then we'll begin recruiting nursing homes. And just to pause for a second to give you a sense of the model we use, 2006, we spent an awful lot of time with nursing homes and with the state to make sure that we understood the nursing home environment. Each kind of organization has a different culture, a different environment, a different legal framework to work in, and nursing homes especially so. Highly regulated, a lot of reporting. We're trying to find a way not to add to the burden, but to find something new and useful to add. So we spent a lot of time talking to the folks at SPD at the state and the nursing home profession. We had an advisory group. We ran a pilot with eight big chains in the state to see if it could work. We put the rules, proposed the rules, and now we're in the final stage of that. So I'm optimistic that because of all that work, we should be able to move the next phase along pretty quickly and actually sign folks up. Ambulatory surgery centers, another critical and perhaps kind of unknown, the kind of quality issues. It's a new invention, as it were, and not a lot is known. And so that industry is gearing up its quality initiatives. I think the Patient Safety Commission has a role as a partner in that and as a spur to quality improvement activities in ambulatory surgery centers. We hope to have the reporting program in place for ambulatory surgery centers by May 1. So we've gone through a pilot with that group. We've drafted rules. We're now vetting those rules. We'll put those in place or put them in the public domain for a discussion probably another month with the hopes of having it all wrapped up by May. So a big chunk of work. Four big reporting programs to be structurally ready by May. And all the while continuing to work on the hospital piece because that's a critical piece. Any questions about the game plan on reporting? It's a critical element of what we do. It provides a unique data set because of the deepness of the information, the richness of the information, the potential to drive quality improvement. And some days I say, I'm sick of this. It's too much work. It's too hard. We're too underfunded. But it creates some interesting opportunities. I want
to well, it's critical information. You've been busy. Yeah, Representative Greenlee.
Jim, I'd like just your impression now. If you believe the IOM reports, there should have been something like something between 100 and 1,000 deaths in any year in Oregon based on things in hospital. And we know Oregon's like, right, we'll be gone above average and that. But to what extent do you think the 57 events you had reported in your first reporting period, including 18 deaths, which is not a trivial, one's not a trivial matter. But to what extent do you think that really did represent the universe of potential events that could have been reported?
Can I just jump in a second, IOM being Institute of Medicine report,
okay.
I assume?
Yes. Yeah, there was a report that indicated something like, what was the number? 100,000 deaths a year.
100 is a 100,000, nice round number. Yeah.
100,000 deaths a year. Yeah. Oregon's 1% of the population, so you would have thought it would about 1,000 deaths a year happening in hospitals. I'm not sure we had 1,000 deaths in hospitals in Oregon altogether, but 18 is a relatively small proportion of 1,000.
Okay. Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Greenlee, in your packet is a draft or a preliminary report of 2006 hospital data, what was reported to us, package in a very simple, get it out fast because we want to be able to talk about this fashion. I'm not proud of the report. It feels a little clunky, but we wanted to get the information out, and it has caused a bit of a stir. That information is May through December.
You're being effective, though.
Yeah, May through December. So there's 4 months. It's missing a quarter plus. So on an annualized basis,
the report had a brisk, kindly bedside manner.
I'm the author. You can write. And the editorial in your packet is about that report, is one reaction to that report. So the question is, is 53 annualized to 79, so say 80 for a year in our first year, is that the right number? Is that appropriate? What does that say about the robustness of the program? Fair rephrase. Very difficult number to know. What is the correct number? What is the anticipated number of events? I think is certainly I expected more. And the conversation at my board of directors level has shifted, however, from we suffer from underreporting to what are the barriers to keep hospitals from reporting. So we feel like we're still in the gear up phase here. We did an evaluation of our own reporting system in November. When we started in May, we said we promised to do a 6-month evaluation to see if this is working. We're going to do a timeout. We're going to ask hospitals what's good, what's bad about what we're doing here. And as part of, we have customers. The Patient Safety Commission has customers, and we need to make sure that we're honoring that. And what we learned is that there's pretty good engagement, but there are some barriers. Our definition set maybe is a little confusing. Our reporting form is a bit clunky, non-technical term. We use a paper system. We need to automate that. And we haven't yet caught the imagination of everybody in each of these organizations. We're trying to change the culture of organizations. There's 54 hospitals. Every single one has a different kind of culture. They're all hospitals. They all do similar things. Everyone has a different culture. Their physicians and their administrators have different kinds of relationships, different kinds of histories, and they embrace or don't embrace the reporting model. So we don't quite yet have engagement, if that's the right word, with clinical teams, with physicians, with nurses. That's something we're going to work on. So short answer, yes, we're suffering from underreporting. The number is, I don't know what the number is, but it's an order of magnitude bigger than it is now. Our intent is to continue to work on understanding the barriers and keep at it. That said, I think we found some interesting information. That said, I think we're actually starting to use that information in powerful ways. Okay. So what are some of those ways? That's point three. Let me not go in the order of this, the handout, but so we collect data. We had 53 events. We have started to issue things that we call bulletins or alerts. Those are high-risk situations that are reported to us that we then disseminate back to hospitals. We are the early warning system, as it were, or one early warning system. Until us, there was no way to say, whoops, this is happening at one place, but no one else knows about it. And that's part of what we do, is we try to reduce the time, the learning curve. There's no need to repeat the same kind of mistakes over and over again. One little big example, a hospital reported to us that they had an MRI, a magnetic resonance imaging machine, and they had a safe place to keep that has a big magnet in it, and you can't bring metal close to it because it gets sucked into the magnet. So the room that these machines are kept in have all the special equipment that resists, not made out of metal or kept at a safe distance. Well, this hospital upgraded from a pretty big magnet machine to a really big one, from a 1.5 Tesla to a 3.0 Tesla machine. And a ventilator that was in there in a corner, the machine was here, the ventilator was over there, flew, when they turned the machine on, it flew across the room and landed in the jowls, the bowels, the opening of this machine. Fortunately, there was nobody in there. But imagine a ventilator like this, literally flying across the room, and it said right on it, safe for MRI use. Patient safety is situational. You have to understand the environment. This is the rule, it always works. And so we were able, and hospitals are beginning to upgrade their MRIs, we were able to quickly get the word out, hey, you need to rethink your suites, your the environmental configuration. You know, it's in some ways it doesn't seem like rocket science, but yet it's important. It's a way to creatively share information that reduces the risk of harm to patients. We had a low-tech version of the same thing, a cataract surgery. When you do the surgery, apparently you use a little plastic tube that drips water into the eye to irrigate the eye, to keep it moist, and so it doesn't dry out during the surgery. The tube had a kink in it. The nurse saw the kink, straightened the tube. The liquid began to flow again, but the tube had a memory. It kinked again. People didn't see it. And the learning was, if you see a kinked tube, you can't fix it. It's broken. Throw it out. And it turned out to a whole bunch of those. And that's an interesting example of something that transcended hospital environment. It arose in hospitals, but in fact, ambulatory surgery centers use similar devices. We were able to share the news outward, not just to hospitals, but to ambulatory surgery centers. So. Again, it's in some ways a humble example, but that's the kind of information we're trying to leverage by creating the safe place to share.
And those are excellent examples. Do you get a sense that the hospitals appreciate that, or I'm just curious what kind of reaction you had when you sent a couple of those alerts out.
I think they do like the alerts. We also do what we're calling patient safety tips, a good idea, and sharing it. It's usually a homegrown quality improvement activity. As part of that evaluation I talked about earlier, we ask about the visibility of these things. Were you aware that we put out an alert? Did it help you? Were you aware that we put out a tip? Did it help you? And pretty positive results. I think if we're getting pushback, it's, again, that creative tension of trying to create a central place. 18 people killed is not necessarily the headlines that hospitals want to focus on. They do a lot of good work. And so to be excoriated, roasted in public, it doesn't necessarily feel good. And so the commission's task is to find that creative center place that says, we want to honor the good work being done by hospitals. We want to share the good work being done by hospitals because that's essential to our mission, to identify quality improvement activities and get the word out. But we don't want to shirk from the fact that people are being harmed in hospitals. And that's our challenge, to not undermine the good work and not create such a negative environment that people don't want to share. So how do you avoid the shame and blame, but be honest about what's going on out there? And so we're constantly trying to find that right balance. That's one of our challenges. So there's a couple examples of how we're trying to use data that's actually reported to us. We also try to be smart about who we partner with. We are actively involved in folks know the IHI, the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. They are a group out of Boston that has championed quality improvement activities through something called the 100,000 Lives Campaign and now called the 5 Million Lives Campaign. They take science-based, evidence-based best practices, say these few things are shown to work, let's all work on them together. So IHI has the ability to find good science and good political moxie to push the agenda forward. And the Patient Safety Commission has partnered with IHI and five other organizations in Oregon to say, we're on point. We believe in this model. We're gonna push it forward. And that's part of our, we want to identify best practices and get the word out and champion them. So we're working with the Hospital Association, the Medical Association, Acumentra, which is the quality improvement organization for Oregon, Care Oregon, and the Oregon Nurses Association. We've all come together to create this network to champion these initiatives. So it's our partnering role. And I think as part of our semi-independent status, we can go out and do it and create those creative partnerships. All right? Enough on point three. Any questions on that?
Oh, I'm just curious about the colored wristbands.
Oh,
having
okay.
been in a hospital for the last 4 weeks looking at the various colored wristbands that my mother was wearing.
Okay, I didn't mention that. Another role for the commission. The colored wristband project, when people go to the hospital, many hospitals use colored wristbands to designate critical dimensions of that person. They have an allergy. They have diabetes. There's a whole bunch of reasons. And they use yellow for this and green for that. And a hospital came to us because we had a relationship with that hospital. It wasn't an event reported to us, but it was as because we've created these partnerships with 54 hospitals, they start to tell us stuff. And they said, you know, we use blue for allergies, and they use green for allergies. That's a little confusing. And so what we did is a kind of mini study of the variation in the use of colored wristbands. We called up every hospital and we said, do you use colored wristbands? And what colors do you use? And we found that all but, I think, eight use them. So eight don't, and eight have chosen not to. All the others do, and they're all over the place. Some use one, some use two. There's one hospital that uses 10 different colors. So we said, this might be a patient safety issue. This might be a transition of care issue. So we worked with the Hospital Association and essentially passed the baton to them. We said, this is something you folks might want to work on. And so we didn't have the capacity to actually take it the next step, but we identified the problem, clarified the problem, started to offer some solutions, handed it off to the Hospital Associations for them to take it the next step. And the end result, the recommendation of the Patient Safety Commission's Board of Directors was that if you use colored armbands, you don't have to use them because there's a good case that the next generation is going to be barcoded. You won't need it. You can just barcode. But if a hospital chooses to use a colored armband, we should use the same ones. And so that was our recommendation. We handed it to the Hospital Association. They're going to work on it. All right? So, again, an attempt to identify, clarify, and partner to drive a change across the whole state. Not one hospital at a time, but all hospitals together.
Yes, and then Representative Gelson.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, okay.
Well, you...
Okay.
Somebody.
let me tell you a story. Let me share a story. Sounds like a funny story at the time, out of my most recent hospital experience and being post-surgical. And I ended up on some drugs and then some other drugs. And then I got kind of weird. And there was indications that I was getting kind of, I mean, weirder than usual, actually. Right.
I was just going to clarify the record.
And then the boat happened.
My family's still talking about New Year's Eve and my complete weirdness. But that night, or the next night, still under the influence of drugs that probably were the wrong dose and the wrong drugs and a variety of other things, I woke up in the middle of the night in a complete and total panic. The only thing I could think about is that I was on a spaceship somewhere and I couldn't move, and it was a pretty terrifying experience. Eventually I noticed there was a phone there, and I saw the phone and I thought, well, maybe I'll call 911 and get somebody to come and help me. I mean, it was really that. And then I noticed a room number, and I ended up calling the hospital operator and saying, I think I'm a patient in your hospital. You get somebody to come and help me. And eventually somebody came, and then actually I called Harriet at 2:30 in the morning to come and hold my hand. But that's not an experience I think that would ever get reported to you, and yet it was in some ways a very significant adverse effect to me. Do you have any thoughts about trying to get reports from patients about experiences they might have had in the hospital that that represented an adverse effect?
Mm-hmm.
An adverse event.
Yeah. Chair Kotick, Representative Greenlick, we struggled with this. We're not set up currently to receive reports from people at large, from patients or family members of patients. And so we haven't figured out how to handle this. We've also gotten interest in staff people reporting adverse events to us. We don't know if our hospital reported it. We think they should. And so we struggled with that. At the moment, we do not. It's on our agenda for our next meeting is to talk about how we might handle that. So that's an open question. We are trying to increase our definition of a reportable event from the most serious to less serious, all the way down to close calls. We imagine stretching the definition over time so that we get events that might not have led to permanent harm or serious harm, but were significant because they pointed out a failure in the system of care. And in the case that you mentioned, ideas that were put in place by this Institute for Healthcare Improvement is this idea of a rapid response team. And the intent was to empower the bedside nurse, anyone who's around, to make a quick assessment if a patient is doing worse than, is not doing well, and that can invoke or bring to quick rescue a rapid response team. And so hospitals are attempting to organize that, and that's something that, as part of this IHI network, the commission is attempting to champion also. But that, how do you bring in those extra reports? There's an awful lot of pent-up interest in that. I get a lot of phone calls, a lot of letters. This happened to me. What do we do? And one of the things, we're just trying to create a sort of manual on what's a useful approach. What can patients do to prevent harm? What can they do when harm happens? And so that, I think that, honestly, that's an underdeveloped but important piece of what the commission does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. Representative Gilson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Greenlick, for anticipating my question and modeling how to ask it. I was trying to figure out how to pull it out of the personal, and I can't. I just want to emphasize that importance of having a way for patients or even other hospitals to be able to report adverse events that happen in other places, and that really needs to be a confidential type of reporting system. Several years ago, I had a child who experienced a series of adverse events at a large hospital, one of which ended up with several emergency room visits and a potential surgical correction later in a different hospital facility. And as my husband and I looked back over the course of the events that led up to that, having asked for help, seeing this train wreck coming through the day, we didn't receive that. And afterwards, being the parents of a child with complex medical needs that needed to continue receiving care from the institution, we chose not to press it because we did not want to compromise his ability to continue to receive care from the only institution in the state that could provide that to him. I know that in talking with other families that have medically complex kids, they had similar questions and concerns about when you see processes that you know, if they carry out, are going to end up in someone being injured. How does the patient have the ability to report that to prevent other injuries from happening without at the same time compromising the ability of that individual to continue to receive care? And then the second piece, when other hospitals are following up with the follow-up care as a result of injuries, adverse incidents that are a result of problems in a hospital, how to make sure that those get reported not for the hospital that's doing the treatment, but for the hospital in which that adverse event or injury occurred.
Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, I've heard at least three kinds of overlapping issues there. One is, how can patients how can we help patients find their voice to be advocates for themselves, for their families, in a way that is useful and not destructive, that doesn't take away the trust, doesn't take away the sense that my clinical team is doing everything they can for me. And that's something the commission needs to work more on. How do we report, how do we accept events that are reported from another hospital about some hospital? That's an ongoing issue, and not unlike the one about, can we accept reports from patients themselves? And that's something the commission is thinking about but hasn't come up with a solution. And I've forgotten the third one. But they're important questions, and the commission was narrowly set up to create a reporting structure, hospital to commission. And that, as we get into this, doesn't feel quite broad enough, quite wide enough. And that's it's on our agenda, but we haven't solved it yet, honestly.
Thank you for that. In the interest of time, maybe do you want to move on to the hospital report? Or
if I may I
or is there a salient point on the last page you want to make sure?
Let me the last point. Page bullet four, the commission is building consensus on important patient safety concerns. One is around written notification. This is a hard but interesting piece of what the commission does. We try to create patient-centeredness, patient accountability, and one way we do that is by insisting that hospitals that report events to us also tell patients in writing. That's a hard thing to do. We haven't been directive on how to do that. The statute is vague. Do it in a timely way. And so we had a workshop in October. 35 hospitals came, spent a day with us talking about how to do that. And the goal was to create it a way that honored the intent, which is that written notification is meant to bring the patient to the center of the conversation. It's not something to work around. It's not a scary risk creator. It's meant to be, this could be a useful way to bring the patient to the center of the conversation. So we had a good workshop on that, and we created and will continue to create a toolkit of ideas on how to do that. So that's something we will continue to work on. And I think others are picking up the challenge to do that, because I see that as, how do you do disclosure? It's a hard thing to do, and it's a critical thing to do, because it speaks to a conversation between a harmed patient and a nervous clinical team. But it speaks ultimately to stewardship and trust, and it goes right to the heart of creating a caring healthcare system. And so it's an important issue, and the commission has the role to play by insisting on written notification. And that comes back to some of what you were saying. And so we'll continue to work on that. We've made a good step. We have there's a good summary on our website of what we learned in that day-long forum, and we'll continue to add tools to that. And then lastly, and this is a heads up, and it speaks to a little bit to House Bill 2524, the mandatory reporting of infections. The Patient Safety Commission created
or has attempted to create a consensus on how Oregon might approach healthcare-acquired infections. So what we've done is aim to have what we're calling a policy summit on the issue. That's scheduled for March 12th at this point. What we've done to date is to create a draft consensus document. We've had 20 healthcare leaders, infection control experts sit down with us in January and February, and last week we hammered out a consensus. We'll talk about that consensus at Thursday's hearing, but be aware that it exists, and it's an attempt to say, create a vision for Oregon, and that vision is stated here, that Oregon should be free from healthcare-acquired infections, and that any solution has to meet the test of trustworthy, effective, transparent, and reliable. I can expand on that maybe on Thursday. But we also created some guidelines, at least for this group, that if you're going to have a reporting program, could be a useful piece of reducing healthcare-acquired infections, but it needs to meet some tests. And we defined 11 tests that that reporting program should meet. And so we're, again, trying to create a consensus, trying to bring very disparate people to the table, hospital association, medical association, public health, health systems, hospitals, epidemiologists. We worked with the Center for Evidence-Based Policy to infuse science into this. So the mantra is consensus, and the mantra is science. And can we fuse the two together and come up with an Oregon approach? And that's what the commission has tried to, again, find the center and was the convening party for this. So we'll see if it works. It feels risky. It feels exciting. And we're right in the middle of it. And as I said, we've just, I think as of this morning, hammered out what I believe to be the consensus document. And we'll circulate that on Thursday. All right.
Look forward to seeing that.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Finally, very quickly, perhaps we published a 2006 annual report on hospital adverse events. There were 53 such events reported in 2006 from May until December. And we have an obligation, and it just makes good sense, to publish an aggregate report for the people of Oregon. This is different than what we would share with hospitals. It's less detailed. It doesn't reveal any specific hospital. It's meant to, and so you should not be able to work backwards from this to this happened at here, this happened there. But this is meant to say, here is a picture of all of Oregon. This is where we are. Do we suffer from underreporting? Probably. Are the data useful? I believe they are.
Yes, Representative Flores.
Thank you. Mr. Damon, your 2006 report notes that there were 52 of the 57 participating hospitals, and then your February update for us here says there's 54. So what categories were those two hospitals from that added in 07?
Madam Chair, Representative Flores, we continue to grow. We've had two hospitals sign up in the last 2 weeks.
Were they from a small, medium, or large?
We got the last of the medium, so one was medium and one was small. All right. So now we have all the large and all the medium. And the three that are left are very, 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 very small.
Thank you.
All right. So I think it is a good sign that we continue to demonstrate we're still going. We're still moving forward. We're not losing. We're gaining. And I think that will happen with reports also. I've always seen this as if this is going to work, and this, and frankly, is an experiment. Oregon is the only state in the country to have a completely voluntary model. Other states have either a mandatory, highly regulated reporting program, or they have a hybrid, some mandatory, some voluntary, depending on the kind of report and the kind of institution. Oregon's the only place that's way out on a limb. We're going to do it completely voluntary. So it is an experiment. Three-pronged test. Can we get hospitals and others to sign up? Yes. Can we get them to report data? Sort of. Can we use the data in a useful way? I think we're beginning to demonstrate that we can. but we're somewhere, you know, in the test, sloshing between 2 and 3. All right. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question about the on the front page. During the month of September, it looks like there was a spike there in reports, and I wondered if there's been some attempt to figure out if there's is there an increased population in hospitals in September, or is it just a fluke, or is there some attempt to figure out why that's a pretty noticeable increase during that 1 month?
Somewhere between August and September, I looked at the numbers, and Chair Kotek, Representative Bonamici, somewhere around August and September, I looked at the numbers and I said, "Look at the trend; we're going in the right direction." And then it dropped off. I think it's more administrative than it is saying something about the frequency of actual events. And I think that, to me, it speaks to a couple of things. Maybe primarily that we've created an information system that overlays other kinds of systems. It's not our program of reporting serious adverse events, I don't believe, is well integrated into the hospital's activities. It's not part of their daily lives. It's, oh gosh, did we report to the commission? So I think that we worked hard. A lot of this is we have a field coordinator, and her job is to be on the horn, talking to hospitals, cajoling, assuring, explaining. Her activity dropped off because she was moving on to other things. The reporting program dropped off. So I think that this points to we haven't yet integrated this into the mainstream information, mainstream mentality of hospitals. It speaks again to culture. It speaks again to we're trying to create a learning model. Oops, I forgot the lesson. So we need to continue to hammer home and help hospitals better integrate this into their activities of daily living.
Right. I just wanted to follow up then that there's no connection necessarily then between the date of the report and the date of the event. So an event can happen and then you might get the report the next week or next month.
Chair Kotek, Representative Bonamici, the part of the ground rules are that we expect hospitals to report an event within 45 days of discovery. And that's written in administrative rules, and that's one of the tests, that if a hospital systematically refused to do that, we would consider termination. And now it's an interesting prospect. Can you terminate someone from a voluntary program? But I think there is some power in this is a public program. The names of the participants are on our website. They're often mentioned in newspapers. This plays in communities. I was at a hospital, Portland Adventist, yesterday, and there was the right in the lobby was a certificate that this hospital is a member of the Oregon Patient Safety Commission reporting program with my little signature on it. And it's what a crummy little signature. But there it was, right where it was supposed to be. And so that's part of the publicness of this. Mm-hmm. But we need to continue to work on that. I don't want to belabor this. It's a preliminary report. I think we're starting to gain traction. There's a bunch of hospitals that haven't yet reported an event. Often difficult to know if that's not paying enough attention or just a really safe place. We'll continue to work on that. A couple of points about the kind of information or kind of events. We've seen a lot of surgical events. We were surprised to see so many retained objects events, so many. Gosh, those still happen. That's what all the doctors tell me. Gosh, that still happens. And we had, I think, 10. Retained objects, and we had a bunch of wrong site surgeries. So these things still happen. A bit of it is—it's a bit of a distortion, perhaps. If you have an undercount, I think it's probably easier to identify a retained object, easier to identify a wrong site surgery than perhaps an infection or an adverse drug event, or something that might seem like a complication of care and not a medical error. And that's a critical definitional difference. We're talking about events that express the failure of the management of the care, not something about the clinical consequences of that care. We're not a complications committee. We are a medical errors committee, which is something fundamental about the management of the patient's care, independent of their clinical symptoms. However, we're convening a group to look at retained objects and see if we can find a consensus solution. What we seem to be seeing is that every hospital has a policy around retained objects. Everyone has a count, a procedure on how to count sponges, how to count guy wires from devices inserted in the vein. But for long surgeries, for complicated surgeries, there are shift changes, there are extra people in the room. The stresses of providing care sometimes crack those policies and procedures and things fail. So there are some real good opportunities here to start to talk about teamwork and about communication and about hierarchy that speak to culture. And so we're putting together a group now to say, okay, what's a smart way to think about this? It's not simply can you count to 10 because there are 10 sponges in there. It's how do you create a better team.
Representative Bonamici,
go ahead. No, you're...
I noticed on your last page, the summary of contributing factors, you talk about communication. And having watched the communication challenges between shift changes at hospitals, will you be looking into those type of staffing-related communication issues? I mean, I know that some of the shifts that nursing staff, for example, are doing and lack of enough staff, high ratios between staff and patients. I don't know. Is that something on the horizon for you?
I think it is. It's a thorny subject. But as part of our reporting framework, we ask hospitals to report to us about the root causes, the contributing factors, and we've laid out a bunch of them that include issues around resources and issues around staffing. So perhaps our contribution will be to see how often those issues are laid to the feet of staffing problems or understaffing or inappropriate staffing. So I think we might have a role in starting to target informationally what's going on.
Because that would certainly be helpful. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Chair Kotek. I have a question about Table 2 on the number of events reported by individual hospitals. I understand that the need for confidentiality and the benefits of confidentiality and how it encourages reporting. But if I had to go to a hospital, or if somebody in my family had to go to a hospital, and I was looking at this report, which is public, obviously, and I saw that there were 19 hospitals that had only one or two events reported during the relevant time period, but there was a hospital that had five events reported, I'd want to know what that hospital was. Can I find out?
Madam Chair, Representative Bonamici, the simple answer is you cannot. As part of our pledge to protect confidentiality, we're not going to share information about individual hospitals. And we believe that that's necessary to keep the flow, to keep hospitals reporting. And the challenge is that hospital that reported five events the worst hospital, or is it possibly the best hospital? And that's the problem, because, and I don't know this, but people who build reporting programs, the VA has a very good national reporting model on adverse events, and their belief is that more is better. These things happen, and if they can create a climate where folks are trusting enough to report, then they can create a useful learning tool. So over time, we might expect to see an increase in the number of reports, not because quality is going down, but because trust is going up. And so that's the problem. It's difficult to give a consumer information, say, this hospital had five errors, this hospital had one. The hospital that had one is the better hospital. I personally don't believe that, just based on that evidence. The net result, I think, would be that the hospital that reported five next year will report one. if we create perverse incentives too. And so that's the challenge.
I do understand that. I just see that you may have a communication challenge here with the public.
I agree. And that's part of this, Chair Kotek, Representative Bonamici, that's part of the challenge, again, of this trying to hold the central ground. Consumers could say, we want this information, you have it, we could make better decisions if you gave it to us. Hospitals say, stop telling the public that we're killing them, and we're somewhere in the middle trying to find a useful, a niche way. And that's our challenge.
I wish you luck.
Well, I actually have a follow-up to that, because I know you're only just now starting to get the reporting, but, you know, a year from now, if you see a hospital who is good at reporting, but they're reporting the same thing, I would want to go, hey, you're reporting the same stuff. Are you not learning from your experience?
Yeah.
Is that, are you empowered to then discuss that with the hospital?
Madam Chair, we are. A couple of things. Part of our accountability model is that we ask hospitals to report their action plans. What are they going to do about a problem? And we've made a pledge to go back once a year. We haven't done this yet, but go back once a year and say, okay, you said you were going to do X. Did you do it, and did it work? It's not so much to censor, but to see what's working. But that's part of hospitals have to make a good faith effort to improve, and if they don't, then and meaning that they're just mailing it in, as it were, the commission is in a position to I mean, sanctions are really termination for the program, ultimately. And the other piece of accountability is that once a year, the public health officer, as an independent agent, needs to certify the work of the Patient Safety Commission. So, again, it's trying to create that independent view. So once a year, the public health officer will look inside the confidential black box, report then to the public, this program seems to be working, it is a robust program, or it's not. And one of the things I would ask is, are hospitals reporting in good faith, are they learning from their mistakes, and we'll get a score. The commission will get a score.
I see we're at 4:30. Thank you very much, Mr. Is it Dameron?
Jim.
We will see you back on Thursday. Any other final? I think we'll see you on Thursday for this discussion.
Thank you very much.
Very informative. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you very much. And thank you for the hard work you're doing, because, I don't know, I somewhat feel a little bit safer in the world that they're actually trying. And on that, I'll close the informational hearing. And just to remind everyone that we are, this is Tuesday. So Thursday we're hearing the bill around hospital inspections. Next Tuesday, this is today.
Mm-hmm. Do we have anything for next week?
Not yet.
Okay, discussion. So the bill on Thursday is 2524. All right, we'll close the committee hearing. Thank you, everyone.